the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, says talks with the visiting IAEA chief were constructive and that what matters is building mutual trust. President Raisi tells Iraqi Prime Minister that Tehran is determined to expand ties with Baghdad, while Mustafa al-Khadami hails Iran for its role in defeating Daesh terrorists. Two more Turkish soldiers are killed in Syria and Iraq, bringing the total Turkish fatalities to four during the past 24 hours. Appreciate you being with us. Well, Iran says it has had constructive talks with the visiting head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The new head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, made the comments after meeting with Rafael Grossi in Tehran. Islami said the talks were concentrated on technical issues, and there have been an agreement over the replacement of old memory cards of the agency's cameras at nuclear facilities. Islami noted that building trust has been of utmost importance for both sides. Grossi also called the meeting very important and positive. He said Iran and the agency must expand their cooperation. The one-day visit by the IAEA chief is the first since Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi assumed office back in August. Now, the visit comes ahead of Monday's meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors. And now it's time for this hour's news review. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says his country is determined to expand relations with neighboring Iraq. Raisi said the two sides are able to further promote their ties in all fields despite outside interference. He was speaking during a joint presser with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadami in Tehran. The Iranian president said the Iraqi side has agreed to a visa waiver regime between the two countries. The Iraqi premier, for his part, said his country attaches great significance to ties with Iran. He also appreciated Iran for its role in defeating the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq. Al-Khadami arrived in Tehran earlier on Sunday for a one-day trip. I'd like to welcome my guest to this news review, Eric Wahlberg, journalist and commentator out of Toronto, and Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, analyst, and author out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Well, Eric, let's start it off and let's talk about the significance of this trip of the Iraqi prime minister to Iran at this point in time.
It has been very important that Iraq and Iran stand together after the assassination of General Soleimani and his Iraqi counterpart. And it really, Iraq is the only country that is standing firmly on this. So the Iran has called for the arrest of Trump for the murder. And he did this when he was, Iran made this claim when there was a meeting earlier this year in Iraq, in Baghdad. So that's very important. And it's also important to note that Iraq and Iran are very close economic allies now. This has been the only positive development out of the American invasion. And it is to both sides' interests, and their interests are mutually compatible. This is something the U.S. Cannot undermine, really. So that's very important to see that this alliance is moving forward, and it's an alliance for peace in the Middle East. So this is holds great hope for all of us that I looked at the disaster that Israel and U.S. have been perpetrating there in the Middle East.
Marcus, your take on the importance of this, because, of course, we know since 2003 with the United States' invasion and then occupation of Iraq, Washington has continually tried to pull the Iraqis towards their direction, at times being effective with that and many times not. Of course, throughout the years, especially in the fight against terrorism, the Iraqis and Iranians have become closer, especially when it was Iran that actually, with General Soleimani leading and helping the Iraqis to free the country of the Daesh terrorists. Tell me the importance of this, and how difficult will it be to maintain this, because do you think that the United States will try to play an active role in destroying this relationship?
Well, despite the illegal American military occupation of Iraq, which has resulted in Washington penetrating the country's key institutions, including the judiciary and the civil service, nonetheless, Iran has managed to forge major inroads in Iraq to the extent that there is considerable consternation about this in Washington. Now, the blossoming relationship between Iran and Iraq is partly based on a shared history, but more important than that, it is based on common cultural and spiritual ties between the Iranian people and the Shiite population of Iraq. Then there is Iran's considerable investment in Iraq, including the construction of Shiite shrines, which has generated many jobs and is therefore a source of revenue, a major source of revenue for the Iraqi economy. Then there is the common threat posed to both the Iranian and the Iraqi peoples from ISIS or Daesh, because the Iraqi people, whatever their faith, be it Shiite, Sunni, or Christian, will always be indebted to the Iranians for having destroyed the presence of ISIS on Iraqi territory and for having liberated the territory which had been conquered and brutally ruled by ISIS.
All right, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this news review. Eric Wahlberg, journalist and commentator out of Toronto, and Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, analyst, and author out of London. Continuing with more news this hour, a flotilla of the Iranian Navy has returned home after accomplishing its mission in the high seas. The Navy vessels arrived in the southern Iranian port city of Bandar Abbas early on Sunday and were welcomed by high-ranking military officials. Present at the ceremony was the commander of the Iranian Army, Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, who praised the crew members of the Iranian Armada for having completed their mission successfully. He said the naval fleet carried out its mission in the worst climatic conditions and amid the enemy's political campaigns and psychological warfare. He said the historic mission was accomplished thanks to the Navy's prudence, knowledge, and bravery under the guidelines of the Islamic Revolution's leader. The commander of the Iranian Navy has given us more details about the mission of the naval flotilla, which came back home after a 45,000-kilometer voyage.
During this mission, this destroyer experienced four seasons and it passed across the two hemispheres. It was important for us to, I mean, my comrades here, it was important for them to hone their skills, to, and they showed their capabilities and they demonstrated their skills. And what was important was that they didn't stop during the mission without any need for any logistics. They went all the way to their destinations and came back. And this shows that in the domain of naval missions, it is important that definitely equipment run into problems, technical problems, one way or another. But their capabilities were so high that we didn't need any assistance from any other ports in other countries. The U.S. does not have a proper understanding of Iran, and they do not know our capabilities. And they just read some reports and Well, you see, anybody who is wise enough knows the capabilities of Iran. So anybody who is wise enough, he or she knows how things play out. So, and this mission was accomplished powerfully, and we will continue our presence with more might and power and with more lofty objectives.
Turkey's defense ministry says two Turkish troops have been killed during attacks in Syria and Iraq. The ministry says one soldier was killed and another wounded in an attack on a Turkish military vehicle in northern Iraq. It has blamed the attack on what it calls separatist terrorists. The ministry says a second soldier died after he succumbed to his wounds sustained during an attack in Syria's Idlib province. The Saturday attack left two more Turkish soldiers dead. Turkey often conducts operations against the Kurdistan Workers' Party and other Kurdish groups in Iraq and Syria. Ankara considers them terrorists. Now, Turkey has maintained its military presence in Iraq and Syria despite opposition from them. Palestinians have gone on a strike in the occupied northern West Bank city of Jenin in solidarity with escaped prisoners targeted by the Israeli regime. The strike comes amid days of a massive manhunt by Israel in the area, where the regime's forces conducted extensive raids and even arrested family members of the escapees. So far, four out of six prisoners that broke out of Israel's maximum security Gilboa prison on Monday have been recaptured and taken to court. Two others still remain at large. Palestinian resistance groups have condemned the manhunt, saying these developments signal a new round of explicit conflict with the occupying regime. Meanwhile, a conference has been held in the besieged Gaza Strip on the 20th anniversary of the signing of the so-called Oslo Peace Accord with the Israeli regime. The National Conference demanded the cancellation of the agreement and asserted the support for armed resistance against Israeli occupation. Our Gaza correspondent Ashraf Shannon brings us more.
A big conference was held in the Gaza Strip on Sunday titled "The Resistance Liberates and Oslo Destroys." Attendees demanded the cancellation of the so-called Oslo Peace Accord that was signed in 1993. In September of that year, the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, signed the Oslo Accord with the Israeli regime on the lawn of the White House in Washington, D.C. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas asserted the failure of the Oslo Accord and affirmed its adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime.
We assert that the shortest way to liberate all of Palestine and the prisoners is through the rifle and the resistance. Armed resistance is the one and only way to achieve the goals and aspirations of the Palestinian people.
The agreement was meant to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but years after signing the Oslo Accord, Palestinians consider it as a terrible chapter in their history.
The world must understand that the Israeli regime doesn't respect any international accords or agreements and only understands the language of force. The Oslo Accord has only brought pain and suffering and disasters to the Palestinians.
The conference comes almost 4 months after the Israeli military bombarded the besieged Gaza Strip for 11 consecutive days, killing at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war.
The Oslo Accord caused the Palestinian rift, while the armed resistance has managed to achieve several victories against the Zionist enemy. The Palestinians are fully backing the resistance, especially after realizing that the Zionist enemy was the only one who benefited from the Oslo Accord.
In its final communique, the conference announced that the Oslo Accord has been a major setback for Palestinians and is even worse than the Balfour Declaration of 1917, which helped create the Israeli regime on occupied Palestinian land. Palestinian resistance factions say that the futile Oslo Accords will not free Palestine and Al-Quds. They maintain that armed resistance is the key to freedom. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
The Yemeni army says its troops, backed by local tribes, have successfully liberated vast areas in Mareb. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, reports.
Yemen's armed forces, backed by local tribes, have successfully conducted the third phase of Operation Nasr al-Mubin. The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariyah, said Mahliya and the Rahaba directorates of Mareb, with an area of 1,200 square kilometers, were fully liberated. The spokesman also said over 150 mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured during the operation.
The Yemeni unit succeeded in fully liberating the districts of Mahliya and Al Rahba during the third phase of Al Nasr al Mubin operation. During the operation, 151 mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition were killed or injured, and a total area of about 1,200 square kilometers were liberated.
Sariyah also hailed the tribes of Mareb for their role in supporting the Yemeni army in achieving the recent victory. Observers said the Yemeni army is now implementing the fourth phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation, aimed at fully liberating all the occupied territories of Yemen.
The third phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation was a strong and important stage for the Yemeni army, which managed to liberate 1,200 Yemeni lands from the mercenaries loyal to the Saudi-led coalition. Military operations are still ongoing, and there is a fourth phase through which the Yemeni army seeks to liberate all of the northern Yemeni lands from all forms of foreign presence.
For months now, the Yemeni army has been intensifying its military operations to liberate the oil-rich province of Mareb from the Saudi-backed forces and terrorist groups. This move was considered as the first step forward to expel foreign forces from the rest of the country.
Yemeni tribes have repeatedly announced their opposition to the presence of any foreign forces, especially those of Saudi Arabia. People here believe that the military will not be able to liberate the country without the backing of tribesmen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And now to China, which says it has administered more than 2 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines across the country. The National Health Commission made the announcement on Sunday. This as the country has registered 46 new daily infections, with 44 asymptomatic cases that China did not classify as confirmed. Currently, the total caseload in the country, the birthplace of the virus, stands at over 95,000. Chinese officials have repeatedly stressed that they would provide vaccines and technical support to other countries, despite domestic demands. President Xi Jinping recently announced that his country would donate 100 million more doses of vaccines to developing countries as part of a global fight against the pandemic. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
Rather than fair and transparent trials, the military commissions created at Guantanamo Bay have been a dismal failure. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading CIA Torture Cover-Up Still Looms Over 9/11 Trials at Guantanamo. Stay tuned for more. U.S. war crimes in the so-called War on Terror were back in the spotlight as pre-trial hearings for alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and four co-defendants resumed at Guantanamo Bay, with a lawyer for one of the men asserting that a continuing cover-up of CIA torture is the reason none of the suspects have been tried 15 years after their transfer to the extra-legal prison. After a 17-month delay due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the five defendants, including Muhammad, his nephew Ammar al-Baluchi, Walid Ben Attash, Ramzi Ben al-Shib, and Mustafa al-Halsasi, appeared before a U.S. military court at Gitmo's Camp Justice recently. The men, two Pakistanis, two Yemenis, and one Saudi, stand accused of what military prosecutor Clayton Trivett Jr. has called the summary execution of nearly 3,000 people in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Pennsylvania during the September 11, 2001 attacks. They face execution if convicted. However, the defendants' attorneys argue that their clients' confessions should be thrown out because they were extracted through torture, evidence of which has been blocked from the courtroom. Experts also say that confessions and information resulting from torture are highly unreliable. Make no mistake, covering up torture is the reason that these men were brought to Guantanamo. And the continuing cover-up of torture is the reason that indefinite detention at Guantanamo still exists, Jay Connell, the lawyer representing al-Baluchi, said recently, adding, "The cover-up of torture is also the reason that we're all gathered at Guantanamo for the 42nd hearing in 9/11 Military Commission on the 15th anniversary of the transfer of these men to Guantanamo." The five defendants, who were all captured in Pakistan in late 2002, and the early 2003 were turned over to the United States before being transferred to CIA black sites, including the notorious Salt Pit outside Kabul, Afghanistan, where suspected militant Gol Rahman was tortured to death in November 2002. In 2006, the prisoners were transferred to Gitmo. All five men were tortured. Muhammad was subjected to interrupted drowning, commonly called waterboarding, 183 times, as well as other torture and abuse approved under the George W. Bush administration's Enhanced Interrogation Program. Hawassi suffered from a shredded rectum resulting from torture. As recently as December 2017, United Nations Special Rapporteur Neil Meltzer warned that al-Baluchi was still being tortured at Guantanamo. The defendant's treatment is thoroughly documented in a 2014 Senate Intelligence Committee report on post-9/11 CIA torture, which found that many innocent individuals were wrongfully detained due to mistaken identity and faulty intelligence, that detainees were subjected to horrific and even deadly abuse, and that the brutality and scope of the program were hidden from key government officials. The report also raised serious doubts about al-Hawasi's guilt. However, in December 2012, then-presiding Judge James L. Pohl prohibited all testimony related to the defendant's capture, imprisonment, and torture. And according to a May 2016 court filing, the Army colonel conspired with military prosecutors to destroy evidence in Muhammad's case. Several Gizmo prosecutors have resigned over what they said is a corrupt military commission system designed to convict every defendant. Former lead prosecutor Colonel Maurice Davis called the trials rigged from the start and said he was told by a top Bush lawyer that acquittals were unacceptable. At least four other military prosecutors requested removal from the military commissions because they felt the proceedings were unfair. Alka Pradhan, a U.S. human rights attorney who has represented Guantanamo prisoners and other torture victims, called the Gitmo Military Commission's purpose-built to launder the CIA torture program. Of the approximately 780 men and boys imprisoned at Guantanamo since 2002, 39 remain following last month's transfer of 56-year-old Moroccan detainee Abdul Latif Nasser, who was jailed for 19 years without charge or trial. Of the 39, 28 have never been charged with crimes over nearly two decades of imprisonment. Daphne Eviatar, director of the Security with Human Rights Program at Amnesty International USA, said in a statement recently, 2 decades after the attacks of September 11th were carried out, the survivors and their families have yet to see any justice, reparation, or accountability for that heinous crime. Rather than fair and transparent trials, the military commissions created at Guantanamo Bay have been a dismal failure, denying survivors and their families justice, skirting United States and international law, and abusing the rights of those who remain imprisoned at the facility.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
aperture.
Welcome back, everyone. We witness how, cloaked in the shadows from the light of public scrutiny, the Bilderberg Group began to form their own self-serving agendas and wielded their immense power and resources to redesign the world in their vision. Yet, today, this old institution faces a new climate thanks to a new wave of savvy investigative journalists who attempt to peel away the secret history and ongoing influence of this organization. Don't go away. Here's the next part.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger has been deeply involved in the Bilderberg Group, attending dozens of their meetings over the years and acting on the Bilderberg Steering Committee. Kissinger faces allegations of war crimes for his involvement in the secret bombing campaign that took place in Cambodia during the Vietnam War in the 1970s. It is alleged that Kissinger willfully engaged in the murder of tens of thousands of civilians in various areas of Cambodia, which led to the destabilization of the country into a civil war, resulting in the rise of the infamous Khmer Rouge. Kissinger is also wanted in several countries for his involvement in supporting the Pinochet regime and the CIA-backed coup that took place in Chile on September 11, 1973. Pinochet, who is now facing a war crimes tribunal, murdered the democratically elected President Salvador Allende and started a military junta, which resulted in the kidnapping, forced displacement, and torture of thousands of men, women, and children in Chile. Henry Kissinger actively supported these actions that were taking place at that time, which constituted crimes against humanity. Kissinger was also involved in a controversial study in 1974 called National Security Study Memorandum 200, in which the basic thesis called for an active campaign for the depopulation of several less developed countries to stem the risk for civil unrest.
Are you still giving out orders like Memorandum 200, where you said depopulation should be hell? Sir, just a question. I'm not going to go to hell, because Memorandum 200, sir? Memorandum 200. Just ask him a question about Memorandum 200 that he wrote in April 24, 1974. It's an honest question. Okay. Kissinger, Memorandum 200. Depopulation.
We're on topic now. We came here, we give you the access. If you want to burn bridges, you can do that.
I don't want to burn any bridges. I didn't. I wasn't disrespectful. I wasn't accusatory. It was a serious question.
We're on topic.
Okay, I understand that. So what about the depopulation? I mean, Memorandum 200. Why are you afraid to talk about your depopulation plan?
Why don't you get lost?
Why should I get lost? It's serious.
Sick person.
Sick person. How am I sick? You're the one committing. Oh.
I hope it's the beginning of a whole new epoch of greater and greater coverage. At the same time, we're in danger because of their designs on the internet. This could also be the high watermark. It really depends on who stands their ground and what the fight will be. Because, of course, we've just broke last week, people from the European Commission, the Dutch woman Neelie Kroes, wants a mandatory internet ID for Europe. Cybercom was launched only 2 years ago. We saw the Stuxnet virus, admittedly engineered from the U.S. and Israeli and other related allies to use against Iran and so forth. On that pretext, they want to take greater and greater control of the web. The United Nations also trying to have a reach over the web.
The Bilderberg Group include many prominent members of the internet and computing world, including National Security Agency Director and Chief of the United States Cyber Command, General Keith B. Alexander, co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes, founder of PayPal and chief Facebook investor, Peter Thiel, executive chairman of Google, Eric Schmidt, founder of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, co-founder of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, vice president, European Commission, commissioner for digital agenda, Neelie Kroes, chief research and strategy officer, Microsoft Corporation, Craig J. Mundy, and many others.
More and more, we're seeing the Iron Curtain of media censorship on Bilderberg and the shadow government, shadow elite, pulled back. So we're seeing Bilderberg basically try to pass the baton off to younger people right now, a bunch of tech folks, Google, Facebook. and others, hoping that the police state tech grid can protect their criminal activity. They're trying to push a global bank as the solution to all our problems that they created. They're openly trying to push more police state systems. They want to end internet freedom. They want to bring in internet IDs.
The mainstream media is no longer mainstream. The alternative is taking over, and they're trying their damnedest to either restrict or shut down the free internet as we know it right now.
The increase of internet-based media has been closely correlated with the decrease of traditional forms of media, such as newspapers and television, which have been monopolized by members of the Bilderberg Group. In their efforts to maintain the control of information globally, influential figures of the media have been routinely invited to participate in the conferences over the years. Peter Mansbridge of CBC's The National attended the meeting in 2010 and has maintained their strict rules for secrecy ever since. Fellow Canadian Heather Reisman is the CEO of Indigo Books, the largest book supplier in Canada, and she is a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee. In 2005, Reisman founded the Hesseg Foundation, which provides grants to former lone soldiers in the Israeli Army to pursue post-secondary education. A lone soldier is an individual who is not from Israel, but chooses to fight in the Israeli military. Other media moguls and organizations that have attended the Bilderberg meetings over the years have included Rupert Murdoch of News Corporation, Andrew Knight of News Corporation and The Economist, Ted Turner of Time Warner and CNN, Charlie Rose, Donald Graham of The Washington Post, and Canadian media baron and former Bilderberg Steering Committee member Conrad Black of Hollinger International and the Telegraph newspaper. While all of these powerful media organizations have been present at Bilderberg meetings over the years, there has remained a media blackout all across the board regarding coverage of this group.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering what your opinions were. You talk a little bit about it in the book of the influence of the Bilderberg Group on the mainstream media, or on just the influence.
The individuals are influential, but their influence isn't magnified by Bilderberg. I went for 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's just a talking shop, and they're almost always wrong, by the way. They didn't see the end of the Cold War coming. They didn't see the economic crisis coming. They're very interesting meetings. They're very interesting people, but they're not coherent. They aren't a group that meets other than for 3 days a year, and the composition of them changes all the time, except for about 30 of us who are on the steering committee.
And how come?
Don't buy into these conspiracy theories. It's rubbish. All they do is talk to each other. I was on that conference circuit for 20 years, the Trilateral Commission, and I went to all of them. And it was fine while it lasted, but I'm getting too old for that. I'm getting tired. But,
okay.
You know.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Right.
But there's no conspiracy in any of them.
No?
No, there's a bunch of people.
How come you never hear about it in the media? Like, I only read about it in your book.
They don't allow the media.
No.
But in order to encourage people to talk frankly, which you do, you get good, frank sessions, but there's no meeting of the minds, particularly.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Fellow Hollinger International Board of Directors member Marie-Josée Kravis has made significant inroads since being invited to Bilderberg by Conrad Black in 1989. Marie-Josée is the wife of Bilderberg member Henry Kravis and has been a member of the Bilderberg Steering Committee for over 22 years. At the trial of the now-defunct media baron Conrad Black, Marie-Josée Kravis testified against him, providing evidence for the prosecution. Other prominent Canadians who have attended the Bilderberg conferences include former Prime Minister of Canada Lester B. Pearson, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, Jean Chrétien, Paul Martin, and Stephen Harper. Many other influential Canadian politicians and business leaders have also attended the secret meetings, including former NDP leader Bob Rae, former Liberal Party leaders Stéphane Dion and Michael Ignatieff, former Premier of Ontario Mike Harris, former Premier of New Brunswick Bernard Lord, former Premier of British Columbia, Gordon Campbell, the Premier of Alberta, Alison Redford, the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper, Nigel S. Wright, and Power Corporation of Canada CEO, Paul Desmarais Sr. In fact, nearly every Canadian Prime Minister back to Pierre Elliott Trudeau has worked for Power Corp.
In 1996, you were at a Bilderberg meeting, and also there was Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin.
I don't know if I was at that meeting. I've only been to a few of them, but I, Bilderberg and Trudeau are not really think tanks. They're simply individuals who get together who are from business, the political world, the media, others, and discuss ideas, and they influence each other through that.
Shortly after Dan and Steve got back from the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, I decided to file some Access to Information Act requests for information on both Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, and for Nigel S. Wright, who is the Chief of Staff for Prime Minister Stephen Harper. I received two notices. One was for Nigel S. Wright, and it actually revealed very little. They just said that they didn't have any record of him having attended the Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, even though he was on the official attendees list. In 2011, the Harper government decided to amend the Access to Information Act and privacy request forms, making it so that anybody that was on the Prime Minister's cabinet was exempt from releasing any personal information. In the case of Alison Redford, the Premier of Alberta, I did receive actually quite a big disclosure from their Executive Council office in Alberta. 31 pages were disclosed to me just the other day. All sorts of different pages have notices to destroy these emails, do not release this information to the public, do not release any information about your travel itinerary prior to attending the meeting. But a lot of the stuff is redacted. A lot of this information is redacted out. That's cited under different sections of the Privacy Protection Act, which is goes hand in hand with the Access to Information Act request. So any other information that was in there about other people has been redacted out. There's also a page in here that describes the nature of the meetings. Off the record, fruitful discussions are enhanced by an atmosphere of mutual trust in which participants can express themselves freely. All discussions are therefore private and off the record. The press is excluded from the meetings. A list of participants will be released to the press on the eve of the conference. There's nothing to hide. If you're doing good things, you don't have anything to hide. There's only something to hide if you don't want people hearing what you're saying. That's the only reason to say it off the record, is that you wouldn't want to be quoted on something that could be damaging to your career.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment.
How do you feel about secrecy in government?
It's a scary thing. I mean, it's secret, so I don't really know much about it.
I can understand if the secrecy is for national security, but, you know, secrecy and covering up, you know, financial documents and things like that, I think as taxpayers, you know, we have the right to know what's going on in our government.
I think secrecy is pretty inherent in the Canadian government, for sure, and in all government. I wish it wasn't that way. I wish government was completely democratic, which would mean that we would be a part of it. But seeing as, like, we have representatives in this House deciding on issues for us, secrecy kind of just comes with that.
I honestly don't think it's a good idea for anybody to be secret. I don't think anything should be secret. I think if anything needs to be said, it needs to be said in front of the people here that can hear it.
We elect people to govern us in a democratic way. And when those people fall, you know, prey to, you know, individuals that have money or, you know, have leverage on them, it's no different than a dictatorship.
When you have, like, government officials and then you have financiers and, like, heads of, like, banks meeting behind closed doors, that's already against the law.
We have really no idea. And without you guys, we wouldn't be around to know, so.
The more independent media that covers events like this or like anything gives a more unbiased opinion, considering how slanted our current media is.
It doesn't have to be a, you know, massive media tycoon that's controlling what's being said anymore. You know, the average person can do it, right? Which is, I mean, you know, that's an amazing feat. We didn't have that 50 years ago. We didn't have that at all.
It's time to get it out there. We should at least know. Should at least know.
Almost everybody here has a camera. They're all doing live streaming. They're all, you know, interviewing people. I mean, there is just everywhere from, you know, really big names with big websites to just people doing their own little thing. And it's crazy. I mean, everybody has a camera this year.
We live in the time of intelligence, of technology, of instant information. And more these people are realizing that, and they're going to realize that today with the hundreds of people that are surrounding the Marriott Hotel where Bilderberg 2012 is being held.
What do you think about, you know, the independent media's these days ability to use social media and live streaming at these kinds of events?
It's amazing, and it shows you how many people that are getting aware and politically aware to this.
And everyone's becoming the independent media because of the double-edged sword that is social media. It's also, of course, a spy tool, as everyone knows.
They're worried about us. They're worried about you. They're worried about every person out here with a cell phone that's able to broadcast live or put the video online, where in the decades past it would require an entire news crew and an assignment, tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Now we can do it standing out here with a cell phone. So their technology that they're using to bug us, their Orwellian nightmare, Big Brothers, or surveillance systems, we're just turning it against them and showing them that we're watching.
What we're seeing here in 2012 represents not just an evolution of social media, of independent media, of the ability of citizen journalists to bring attention to causes that and events that the mainstream media will refuse to cover.
You had thousands and thousands of people watching live stream video. You know, they're interested. People are dying for real information, truth.
We are able to pretty much broadcast to the world, to thousands of people, live, unedited, uncut, as everything's happening. Pretty much just through a cell phone. It's, you know, we're living in amazing times. The technology is advancing.
It's like more than it's a protest. It's almost an independent media summit. You know, there are at least 20 cameras here live streaming, not all like with some central hub. No, 20 independent media outlets, 20 individuals doing separate live streams.
We are making a difference. We are forcing the mainstream media to cover these events, you know, and they are coming kicking and screaming, but they are coming.
If you had an opportunity to maybe say a short little message to the people in that room, the people sitting around that table, what might you say to them?
That's a hard question.
It's a tough one, I know. It's a tough one. I don't mean to put you on the spot. It is.
Second. But if I could say anything to the Bilderbergers is, when you do things in darkness, they will come to the light. And they are. We're here just to shine that light. I don't hate you. I'm not going to spend my energy just to negatively go after you. But I will expose you, and I will talk to you, and I will communicate with you with words to try to make you and the world understand that there's a lot more going on than we actually know, and we deserve to know what's happening. We're human beings. We're just as equal as you, and we're all in this world together.
My message to the globalist is the sleeping giant that is humanity is awakening. It's 1776 against their 1984 worldwide. Their system of 1984 against the spirit of liberty, and they will be defeated, and they know it, and they're starting to run scared, and they should be, because information is power. And the truth is setting us free.
We know who you are, and we're taking our fate back.
We know who you are, and we're going to expose you all the way. So we're not stopping. We're going to be growing in numbers 100 times this in the future. So just wait. Just wait. We're coming.
I'm sure you guys realize, you know, that this is the fate of the planet. You guys are in control one way or another. People are finding out what's going on.
Life is short. We should live it to the fullest and treat people with respect, honesty, dignity, and compassion. And you could change your life in any moment, any time, and just think about the decisions you're making and how they affect people and how they hurt people, and understand there's real consequences for those decisions that you guys have made, that you guys will have to live with for, and eternity, pretty much.
When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, Satan said, if you bow down and worship me, I will give you the world. Well, guess what? You've got the world, and we're not going to bow down and worship you. Those filthy deeds that you have done in secret are now being shouted from the housetops. We are on to you.
The reach of the Bilderberg Group extends to every level of the policy apparatus in both the private and public sectors. Its members over the years have been the most influential and powerful individuals in the world. Whether or not they act in concert with each other or simply influence one another through these meetings is beside the point. The decisions made by each of these individuals have a ripple effect for the rest of the world. For every action, there is an equal but opposite reaction. The creation of this new Orwellian technotronic society has spawned a new generation of warrior, information warriors, whose weapons are the very technologies created to enslave them. As the old forms of media slowly die away, this generation is finding new and exciting ways to spread information, open dialogue, and become the true citizen media. The Bilderberg Group and the individuals that attend are now facing a revolutionary adversary, an informed citizenry armed with the right questions and looking for the true answers.
Well, in shining a much-needed light upon these unprecedented levels of secrecy and powerful world players, this new age of citizen media bravely contends that the Bilderberg Group's lobbying powers represent nothing less than a threat to the democratic process. Well, that's it, everyone, for this week. But join me here next time for another documentary. Bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.